This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Barack Obama ran into some trouble at the Summit of the Americas meeting this past April. For the first time, the leaders of many South American countries voiced disapproval of the American-led war on drugs, and they began talking about alternative strategies. Violent suppression of the narcotics trade has intensified criminal violence in countries like Mexico and Colombia. At the summit, leaders from those countries and others called out the United States for its failed drug policies. Some favor decriminalization, others legalization. The U.S. refuses to consider either one. The battle to end drug traffic seems as futile today as prohibition of alcohol in the 1920s. And that raises the question, is it time to reconsider our strategy? Joining us from a studio in Cincinnati is Isaac Campos. He's the author of the book Homegrown: Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs, and he is also an assistant professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. Isaac Campos, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're taking phone calls this hour and emails. Is it time to end the war on drugs? Should we consider legalization or decriminalization? Call us at 877-962-9862. Email sot@wunc.org. Isaac Campos, the war on drugs seems like it has been with us a long time. How and when did it start?
Well, people often say that the war on drugs began with Richard Nixon in the early 1970s, but it's actually much older than that. I would date and I think most historians would date the actual beginnings of the war on drugs as we know it now. So that is a policy that focuses on the prohibition of drugs, on the suppression of drug use by the incarceration of drug users, and a policy that tends to fetishize certain substances in particular, so that is the opiates, cocaine, and marijuana. You can date those policies back to the early 20th century in the United States and in much of the world. So the real benchmark or the real landmark in U.S. drug history is the passage in 1914 of the Harrison Narcotics Act, which for the first time put serious restrictions on the distribution of the opiates and cocaine. There was another Import-Export Act in 1922, which some people cite as the real beginnings of drug prohibition in the United States. And I think this is where, with the Marijuana Tax Act in 1937, which essentially prohibited marijuana, you have the beginnings of what would become what we now know as the war on drugs. So that is a prohibitionist policy that has led to the emergence of a large black market and ultimately to the kind of violence that we see today in Mexico.
It's always interesting to go back and figure out what was going on when important legislation like that is passed. So what's happening in 1914 that we decide all of a sudden it's time to limit or end the import of opiates?
Sure. Well, it's several decades in the making, really, and it was a confluence of a number of different factors. So it's actually quite a complex history. But the beginnings are in the 19th century when there was the discovery and synthesis of certain new drugs that were hailed as wonder drugs. So morphine in the early 19th century is the most important alkaloid in opium, and it was synthesized for the first time in the early 19th century and hailed as a miracle drug because in many ways it was. It was a drug that took away pain effectively, as everyone knows, and particularly with the emergence of the hypodermic needle in the 1830s and 40s, you suddenly had a drug that could solve a lot of problems in an era when medicine was often powerless to solve most problems for people. You could at least take away their pain, which was a very good thing. Sure beat leeches and bloodletting and that sort of thing. So morphine comes on the market in the 19th century. Cocaine shortly afterward, which is the main alkaloid in coca. Cannabis is also emerging as an important medicine at the time, though its important active ingredients weren't synthesized for a much longer time. Heroin discovered at the end of the 19th century. So we have the emergence of these drugs that are quite powerful, that they are very powerful in small doses, and they start to be overprescribed by physicians. This is the main source of rising levels of addiction in the late 19th century. But also they were being marketed in really unscrupulous ways by patent medicine manufacturers in the United States. So there were no regulations on these patent medicine manufacturers until about 1906 with the Food and Drug Act. And because of that, these patent medicines are essentially, these are medicines that wouldn't say what was in the ingredients. It would be a soothing syrup, for example, if your child wasn't sleeping through the night and you could give them the soothing syrup and you didn't know what was in it, but they just told you it helped them sleep. Well, what was in it was, maybe 25% morphine, for example. And surprisingly, that helped them sleep very well. But after a week or two, they became very ornery when you didn't give it to them. So these kind of abuses raised a lot of awareness of problems with drug addiction. There were some other contingent factors, and I won't go on too long. For example, United States after the war with Spain in 1898, takes over the Philippines. There's a lot of opium use in the Philippines. Missionaries who are there become very concerned about this, and this leads to pressure on the federal government to do something about the opium problem both abroad and at home. There is professionalizing. Physicians and pharmacists are professionalizing and eventually get realize that if they gain a monopoly over the distribution of these substances, then they will become more powerful, and it's very much in their interest to do so. So they begin participating in this prohibitionist process. And of course, there's the very strong movement against alcohol, which was the most important drug of abuse in the United States and really the world in the late 19th, early 20th century. And that those temperance movements helped to really build a lot of strong support for prohibitionist policies on all drugs, not just alcohol.
Were there any correlations between the drugs that were outlawed and the kind of people that folks thought were using those drugs?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad you said that because I left that out. That's a crucial part of the story. So one of the things that – so the typical opium addict, for example, in the 19th century, for most of the 19th century, had been an upper-class white woman. And it was, people weren't too worried about it when it was just upper-class white women. But in the late 19th, about the 1890s, you start to get a shift of opiate use from upper-class white women into more lower-class urban populations, both as white and minority. You also have, of course, a lot of Chinese immigration in the late 19th century, and they bring with them opium smoking, which raises a lot of concern among ordinary citizens, but also labor leaders and that sort of thing who want to get the Chinese out, of course. So the first prohibitionist statute actually we have in the United States against opium is in San Francisco in the 1870s, I believe it was, and that was clearly aimed at the Chinese population. Cocaine eventually became associated with African Americans in the South and was seen as something that made African Americans especially violent and made them go on these murderous frenzies or attack white women and that sort of thing. So there was an enormous amount of racism also involved in this, and the association of these drugs with so-called undesirable populations led to their demonization in many ways.
And the idea of what the drug does to you and who's using it is important in all these wars on drugs. And I think one thing your book points out is that we think of the war on drugs today, especially when we talk a lot about the border, as an American effort to prohibit drugs and working with countries that produce those drugs to kind of work hand in hand to keep it out. But Mexico had its own war on drugs long before there was any kind of U.S. Policy about this. Tell us about the history of the Mexican war on drugs.
Yeah, sure. Well, the real foundation of prohibitionist policies are not so pernicious as the prohibitionist policies have wound up being. So in most places, people eventually recognize that there should be some kind of restriction on the distribution of powerful medicinal substances. It turns out that in Mexico, this recognition was made much earlier than it was in the United States, and this was a part of the Spanish colonial legacy, and that was in itself a part of the legacy of the Islamic colonial legacy in Spain beforehand. So already in the 16th and 17th centuries, Spanish authorities were beginning to create the kind of laws that are sort of the centerpiece of international drug regulations in the 20th century, requiring that dangerous substances be distributed only by prescription, mandating very strong penalties for people who violated these laws, and so on and so forth. In Mexico, what you end up seeing is the development of these laws beginning the colonial era, so down to the early 19th century, and then their continued development during the 19th century. They weren't particularly strong laws in Mexico during that period because Mexico had a strong federalist system. So it was very difficult for the federal government to control things out in the states in Mexico, and that wouldn't change until 1917. But the building blocks were really there already in the 19th century. And then in Mexico, as I show in my book, we get a very early development of the kind of anti-drug hysteria and demonization and ideology that serves as also a crucial root, crucial foundation for these drug war policies. So marijuana in Mexico became overwhelmingly associated with violence and madness. Almost everyone believed that marijuana caused madness and violence in its users. And this idea was so widespread that marijuana was seen as really the worst of all the drugs. People talk today about how marijuana is a gateway to harder drugs. Well, in the early 20th century in Mexico, people talked about how harder the drugs we consider now harder, the opiates and that sort of thing, led to the worst drug of all, which was marijuana. And those ideas started spreading actually to the U.S. in the early 20th century and helped to serve as the foundation for U.S. The U.S. demonization of marijuana in this country.
Well, and we do have this thing now called the war on drugs. It does involve Mexico. The violence there seems to be increasing dramatically in the past decade or so. Is that so, and how much?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely so. The violence that we're seeing now actually occurred in about 2004. Most people date it to 2006 because this is when President Felipe Calderon came into office and he declared that he was going to crack down on the drug traffickers. And that certainly helped amplify what was going on. But we already had some significant turf wars in Mexico in 2004 between these increasingly powerful drug trafficking organizations. These were organizations that had been becoming especially powerful since the 1980s. When crackdowns on cocaine traffic through the Caribbean from Colombia started moving a lot of the traffic into Mexico. So there's this gradual development of more and more powerful drug trafficking organizations. The capture of the top capos, as they're called, or kingpins in these organizations, often led to splintering of some of them. And this leads to some turf wars in the mid-2000s. And then when Calderon tries to crack down and rein in these groups, we have this just absolutely extraordinary explosion of violence over the last since 2006, there have been about 50,000 deaths connected to this drug violence in Mexico.
6 years, 60,000 deaths just in the last 6 years. I want to take a break right here, and then we are going to come back. Talking with Isaac Campos from WVXU Studios in Cincinnati. He's the author of the book Homegrown, Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs, and assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati. Just ahead, we're going to talk about what the world would look like without a war on drugs. Art Benavie joins us for that part of the conversation. We'll take your phone calls at 877-962-9862 on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today about the war on drugs and thinking about a world without it. I'm talking with Isaac Campos, the author of Homegrown, Marijuana and Its Origins of Mexico's Drug War, War on Drugs, I should say. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. And joining us now is Art Benavie, an economics professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of the book Drugs, America's Holy War. Art, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here.
Taking phone calls at 877-962-9862. We've had this war on drugs. May have been going back to the beginning of the 20th century. Art, how are we doing? What's the status?
We're not doing good. I wish I could be a little more optimistic about this. But I think the point is, yes, it's been since 1914 or 18. We've had kind of a war against drugs. It kind of middled along until the 80s. And with this conservative reaction of the country in the 80s, laws were passed under the Reagan administration with Democratic help so that the police, the state and local police, were drawn into the war and they can make profits by seizing your property and confiscating your property without bringing charges and without actually proving beyond a reasonable doubt that your property violated the drug law.
But tell us how that works.
Well, it works because because the civil law was passed under the Nixon administration, which was then beefed up under the Reagan administration. So that what happens is, if the police on suspicion take your property, okay, they suspect maybe on the basis of some anonymous informant that your property has violated the drug laws. What they then do is they circumvent the state laws, which very often want the value of that property to go into education or welfare. They take it to the federal government. That's the way the law is. The federal government then takes the case, okay, and 80% of the people whose property are taken are not charged, and about 80% don't bother even going after it. And then the federal government then, they can forfeit the property, they can confiscate the property, and then here's the point. 80% of the value of that goes to the state and local police, state and local law enforcement.
So you can finance your whole operation by seizing property that may be the proceeds of a drug interaction or drug transaction.
Exactly.
You don't have to prove it. You don't have to go to court.
You don't have to prove it. The level of proof is a very low level of proof. The proof is called – it's more likely than not that you're pride. You have to actually – if you do go into court and try to get your property back, it's up to you, the property owner, to prove that your property didn't break the law. So what's happened as a result of this is there's been a skyrocketing of the drug war in the 1980s, and now you've got groups all over this country that are feeding at the trough, that are making profits. I mean, government is doing it, people who work for prisons are doing it, and the state and local law enforcement, of course, are making an awful lot of money from it. I don't know exactly how you can turn that around. It's pretty deeply rooted in the law, and even the Supreme Court enthusiastically backs this whole thing.
So
that's how with laws.
So they've supported all these.
They support all right. This whole. It's called civil asset forfeiture.
So, but you're an economist. It seems to me, and you've made this point in your book. We're spending what $44 billion on drugs.
And we are spending. Yeah. Let me tell you how much we're spending. The most recent estimate, Jeffrey Miron of Harvard, did the budgetary impact. His most recent estimates. We're spending $41 billion a year right now for enforcing the law. We could get about $47 billion in tax revenues if we legalized, and legalized is a very fuzzy word. Maybe I should say something. What we mean by legalized when we're talking about that is that the government will take over the control and regulation of these illegal drugs instead of the criminals. That's what we're talking about, legalization, because when people are really in favor of the drug war, they'll use legalization to hit you over the head with that vague term.
Right. So, but it would be legal. It would be then vetted. You would have some kind of standards.
Like alcohol.
And taxes. So you could actually have a net turnaround of $77
billion. $88
billion. $88
billion. Exactly is the current estimate. Exactly.
Coming back into
those resources would be available to us.
Isaac Campos, what about that? The idea of a kind of narco-industrial complex, to what extent does that play into the picture in Mexico?
Well, in Mexico, that's a good question. That's not usually... I don't think that's been a central part of what's been going on in Mexico. I mean, one thing we've seen in Mexico certainly is that when Mexico has often dragged its feet on certain drug war measures that the United States has wanted to carry out in order to be able to extract some things from the U.S. So, for example, in the 1970s, Mexico, after some resistance, went along with a new program called Operation Condor, which allowed for the spraying of herbicides on opium and marijuana crops out in the mountains. And one of the reasons it appears that Mexico finally went along with this was because the United States was willing to supply Mexico with a lot of helicopters and a lot of equipment and training and that sort of thing that could be used not only against the war on drugs or in the war on drugs, but also against guerrillas in the countryside in Mexico and that kind of thing. So certainly the police forces and the military, I think, get a boost from the existence of the war on drugs in a way that's similar to what's going on in the U.S. What we also have in Mexico that's really crucial, I think, as far as this goes, is that a different dynamic. There's certainly corruption in the United States, but there's an enormous amount of corruption in Mexico, particularly within the police. And so the police... police commissioners in various places get paid off to allow drug trafficking to go through and that kind of thing. So it winds up being a really critical part of people's budgets there, not only, police forces' budgets, but also the actual salaries of people and that kind of thing. So there is a really crucial economic dynamic there, though I do think it's a little bit different in Mexico than in the United States.
Well, and paradoxically, the effort to clean it up, when corruption gets built into the system, when the government in Mexico oversaw the drug lords. You point this out in your book. There was relative peace. The war breaks mm-hmm. out when you try to crack down and everybody has to fight for their piece of the pie. But explain that for us if it's true.
Sure. Well, the going theory of why the violence has broken out in the last decade or two, the violence has broken out in the last decade and then things were developing earlier than that. One of the crucial parts of the going theory is that under the single-party rule that existed in Mexico between 1929 and 2000, under the PRI party, which ruled there, this was a corporatist system that basically governed the entire country. It was, some people have called it, the perfect dictatorship. And it wasn't a strong dictatorship, but it was one that the PRI had its hands in everything around the country. It also had very strong Cold War security forces. And the going theory is that between the power of the PRI in general and these Cold War security forces, they were able to keep the lid on drug traffickers through payoffs. Essentially, they would take down some traffickers and then they would allow other traffickers to make certain payoffs to be allowed to have certain trafficking routes. And this was the system in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s as these things were going on. But as I mentioned before, in the 80s, when you have this rerouting of cocaine through Mexico, you begin to have larger and larger profits and begin to get increasingly powerful drug trafficking organizations. And this coincides with the democratization process in Mexico that was taking place from the late 80s through the 90s and ultimately resulted in the year 2000 with the fall of the pre-party for the first time in a presidential election and the takeover of the country by the PAN, the National Action Party, which is the ruling party right now. And many people argue that when the PRI fell out of power, these old controls over the traffickers also fell out of power, and we wound up with this situation. I think that isn't the whole story. We also have to factor in that these groups became increasingly powerful since the 80s, right? But this was kind of the tipping point that led to these groups really getting out of control.
Let's go to the phones. Ralph is on the line from Fort Bragg. Hello, Ralph.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I guess I've got a comment. I'd like to see more studies done with geography than history or political science.
Meaning what?
And I guess I should probably, you know, expand on that a little bit or elaborate a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. First of all, these are looking at retrospective studies, looking at nostalgia, the past, everything else, which is part of the problem. But the real question is, how do you do this land distribution? How do you change the human landscape unless there are environmental study designs? And this is where geography comes in. You know, it's a cultural issue, the whole drug problem, that becomes more complicated than what's done in the emergency room, becomes more complicated than what's done, between people trying to fight villains and save lives and search for truth. The reality is that people do two things. There's movement between people trying to avoid pain and people trying to move towards pleasure. So within that, those movements, I think more spatial analysis has to be done with geography and geographic information science. And that's the strength of the United States right now. You know, and unless there's more investments done in the municipal level to look at the complexity of how drug routes are being established, you know, because I'm originally from Panama. I grew up in North Carolina. And, I've been all over the world because of military deployment. And one thing that happens everywhere in the world is that it boils down to is the environment. You know, it boils down to how people are living in the spaces and how they're constructing spaces.
Well, let's take that question. Drug. It's a good one. And let's look at it. Ralph, thank you so much for the call. And so the question is the geography. Let's begin with the geography and the social geography of the marketplace. And that is the United States of America, where all these drugs are being used. Art Benavie, does the war on drugs suppress the use of drugs in the United States? And does it make for a healthier environment because we're keeping all these drugs out?
Well, the thing is, when you have a tremendous demand for these illegal drugs. I mean, about 150 million Americans have used these illegal drugs. Given that demand, when you try to criminalize the use of those drugs, the legal use of those drugs, what happens? The demand doesn't vanish. It goes underground. And when it goes underground, you create these enormous profits for these mob-controlled drug cartels. And the profit margins are enormous. I mean, some recent numbers that I saw, for example, you buy a kilo of cocaine, for example, in Colombia, it's going to run you maybe $4,500. By the time it gets to the United States and is smuggled into the streets of the United States, it costs $400,000 on the average. Now, how is law enforcement going to stand up to a profit markup that big? Now, in Mexico, it's my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong about this, Professor Campos can respond to this. It seemed to me that when Fox came in, Vicente Fox in 2000 in Mexico, prior to that, it seemed to me that they were pretty much nodding and winking at the drug cartels. They allowed them to sell. And at that point, the violence was minimal, as I understand it. The minute they went there and started fighting with them, and especially under Calderon, that's when the violence suddenly escalated. So I would just say, generally speaking, that yes, I agree with the caller in the sense that I think there are certainly cultural issues that are very important in the drug war. I think the drug war is hitting at certain groups that we don't that many people are afraid of, like African Americans, Latinos. I think that is a major force for maintaining the war, as well as the money that I was talking about.
What are the alternatives? We've mentioned legalization. Decriminalization is something else that's talked about.
Right. The decriminalization, it seems to me, if you're going to say decriminalization usually means that you will allow people to use the drug and make it a very minimal crime for – this is for the consumer. But it seems to me that what's missing here is that if you don't make the production and distribution legal, then you're going to continue to have these drug these mob-controlled violent drug cartels. The only way – that I can see that you can eliminate, destroy these drug cartels is what we did with alcohol. You don't have violent alcohol cartels out there anymore. You make it legal, and then people are going to buy the legal drug. You control it and regulate it and make it legal. That is a sensible thing to do.
Isaac Campos, what would legalization –
you agree with me, Isaac?
Yeah, I wonder about that and what impact would that have? Just legalization, let's say – let's stick with legalization, say in the United States. Would that have any impact on the violence in Mexico?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that's absolutely that and I agree with Art that the decriminalization is just a half measure. I mean, it would be good in some ways in the United States in that we wouldn't be locking up, you know, hundreds of thousands of people for drug crimes, and that would be good for reducing the prison industrial complex.
I'm glad
and so
you agree
on
with
so
that.
Only legalization, some sort of legalization, there are a lot of different kinds of things on the table one could consider as far as that goes. Only that would have a real significant impact on the violence in Mexico. The DEA itself says that 60% of the traffickers' profits in Mexico come from marijuana. So simply legalizing marijuana would take a huge bite out of their profits. And I want to mention two things, a couple historical things about legalization. First of all, what we had in the 1920s with alcohol prohibition is misnamed. Now we talk about prohibition as not allowing users to use drugs, but in the 20s, users were allowed to use alcohol. It was just on the suppliers. So
that was actually
a decriminalization scheme in the 20s, and we still had an enormous amount of violence.
Good point.
The second thing I'd like to add is that we already know what essentially a legalization regime would look like in the United States, and that's what existed prior to 1914 and really especially prior to 1906. And if we look back at that period, we had all the elements for a perfect storm of some kind of, you know, drug epidemic, a terrible apocalypse that the drug warriors would probably tell us was going to happen if we legalized drugs. We had new drugs on the market that people weren't particularly familiar with, so morphine and cocaine and heroin and so forth. These drugs were freely available. Almost no states had serious pharmacy regulations until the turn of the century.
Coca-Cola.
well, sure, there's cocaine and Coca-Cola.
It was really
so
Coca-Cola.
There's almost no regulations. We have these patent medicines, as I was talking about before, these soothing syrups and everything else that are full of morphine and cocaine. It's a drug abuse nightmare. And in addition, we had no strong public health movement to try to cut down on drug abuse. So we have all these factors that should have created some sort of apocalypse. And what we had was a system, a situation. We have very good historical research that shows that the number of opiate addicts in the United States, so opium smokers, morphine users, heroin users, never exceeded before 1914 about 300,000 people, which means about 0.5% of the population. And that's about the number of people who were addicted to heroin, according to the UN, in the United States in 2002. So we still we have the same problem, but then we had the worst situation possible. I would caution people to not worry too much about an apocalypse. If we have a system that is more regulated, where we have the sale of drugs, but that you can't be exploited by manufacturers as you could 100 years ago, where we give real information on the dangers of these drugs, we should have a system that, as Art was saying, will look something more like alcohol, where we still have some people have problems, but the vast, vast majority of users are not going to develop addictions or problems in their lives because of these drugs.
Art?
Can I just make this point in reinforcing what Isaac said? Prior to criminalizing the use of opium and cocaine, you know, 1914, 1918, the use of heroin was declining.
Mm-hmm.
And the studies show that back then the rate of use per capita was less than it is now.
But this also gets us right back to this kind of irrational element that underlies our drug policy.
That's right.
If you see Chinese immigrants using this drug, then suddenly the demonization of this drug makes it a much more potent problem than the statistics would bear out.
We can see this. We can see the cultural bias so clearly with so many examples. Let me give you just one. all the experts on the drug war say that if we provided clean needles to people who are drug injectors, that it would bring down the rate of death. It would bring down the rate of HIV being transmitted, HIV virus being transmitted. We know, for example, that because of these dirty needles, which are related to the drug war, we have something like 9,000 children under the age of 13 who have AIDS. And we have one quarter of the AIDS cases due to these dirty needles. And that's directly related to the war on drugs. Now, what did the Obama administration's recent budget do? Of course, it's not just Obama administration's budget. But with clean needle, he zeroed it out. So there's something that would save lives. It would cost very little, and they zeroed it out.
Can we? Sure. And can I just add to that? We know, over the last 10 years, the Portuguese have created a decriminalization scheme where they still prosecute penalized sellers of drugs, but users are sent to drug courts instead they go before what's called a dissuasion commission, who sends them to treatment or does nothing, or depending on what the commission decides. And over the last 10 years, the overdose deaths in Portugal have plummeted, as have the number of cases of HIV contracted through dirty needle use. So what Art's saying is absolutely correct, and we actually have a case right now in the world that shows that this is absolutely the case.
Yeah, does it? And I've got about 30 seconds left. Any impact on violence or substance abuse rates overall in Portugal?
Yeah, substance abuse is actually down, though I would caution one thing we've learned historically is that drug abuse rates are only loosely correlated with drug law. So drug abuse rates go up and down, right? And what that means is that drug laws actually don't do a lot about making people decide whether they're going to use drugs or not. And so, yes, rates have gone down in Portugal, but we can't be certain that it's all because of this. It's almost surely not all because of this policy.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Isaac Campos, author of Homegrown, Marijuana and the Origins of Mexico's War on Drugs, and assistant professor of history at the University of Cincinnati. Art Benavides, an economics professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His book is Drugs, America's Holy War. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thanks very much.
Just ahead, we find out the connection between Jules Verne and North Carolina. Stay tuned to The State of Things.